Hey everybody, it's Paul, I'm an alcoholic. I go to what, just before 7?
About 5 or 7.
Okay, cool. We'll see what comes out. So, got sober May 30th, 1997. My home group's actually the Darnestown Men's Group in Darnestown, Maryland. So, if you are ever in need of a meeting at 8:30 on a Saturday morning, there's about 30 of us guys in a basement. We read the daily reflections, and everybody gets a chance to share. It's a nice little meeting that way. And I was telling the guys I was having dinner with before, as I was helping founding this meeting about a year and a half ago, and we had no real format when we got going. And we read from the daily reflections, and so the first time, being a big group of dudes, we went in without a plan, and so we read the first time, and then immediately our chair looks and goes, okay, what do you have to say? And that just became the format. First person reads, and then we go around the table, and everybody says something about the reflection. Now, we've been doing this for about a year and a half. Yesterday, somebody volunteered to read, and they go, okay, go ahead, start. I was not prepared for this. So that's kind of where it's going on now. But I wanted to read something first because it's been on my mind lately from Dr. Bob's story. And it's on page 180. And it's the question which might naturally come into your mind would be, what did the man say or do that was different from what others had done or said? It must be remembered that I had read a great deal and talked to everyone who knew or thought they knew anything about the subject of alcoholism. But this was a man who had experienced many years of frightful drinking, who had almost all of the drunkard's experiences known to man, but who had been cured by the very means I'd been trying to employ. That is to say, the spiritual approach. He gave me information about the subject of alcoholism, which was undoubtedly helpful. Of far more importance was the fact that he was the first living human with whom I had ever talked who knew what he was talking about with regard to alcoholism from actual experience. In other words, he talked my language. He knew all the answers, and certainly not because he had picked them up in his reading. That, to me, is kind of the reason we're all here, is the idea that it is one drunk talking to another that carries the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I kind of start with the now and then go back to drinking because I start getting on tangents and rambling, and then next thing you know, I'm, you know, not sober yet and have 5 minutes to go. Right now, like I said, I got sober in 97. I just got 20 years this year. And a lot has gone on in this year that I didn't expect. And even a few years ago, had a couple curveballs at me thrown that I didn't expect. I met my wife in sobriety. And we've been married for a little over 15 years now, and about 2 or 3 years ago, she realized that she was not alcoholic. That's her story. She's Al-Anon. I can say with extreme backing of being out with her and just looking at her going, you're not going to have another? That she's not. And we had this conversation in our kitchen, and I still remember it to this day, that I had gotten home from a meeting, and I could tell that she was really wrestling with something, and she brought it up to me that, you know, she's not alcoholic and has tested the waters and knows that she's not, and, you know, worked through this with her sponsor at the time, who was also an Al-Anon, and her words to me were, my biggest fear is that you're going to think the same thing too, and then we're screwed. And I said to her, and it still means a lot to me now, is that really the first time I read the doctor's opinion, because my first night sober, I was not going to sleep right away, and I had a lot of things on my mind, so I was given a book and I read it, that it made sense. Like, the world kind of exploded and came back together again right away with going, oh, they get it. Okay, I get this. I can work with the material here. I can do something with this. And for that, then, it kind of laid out a track for me in my sobriety at that time with the curveball of going, well, why am I going to meetings? And I was kind of looking over this time. It's like, well, that's our social life, our fellowship. But it's not our social life and fellowship anymore. This is my program. And I had to look at just some different things I was doing. You know, where was I with inventory for myself? Where was I with my own prayer life? Where was I with the relationship with my sponsor, with the guys that I sponsor? And had to really realize that I was, you know, 17 years sober, but had to figure out if I was really doing this for me, if I was doing this because I truly believed I had the twofold illness of alcoholism, which, as I get into my story, you'll find out I do. Or was I just, you know, going through motions? And I made some changes at the time. You know, my sponsor is still my sponsor today. Josh and I still work together and, you know, talk once or twice a week about what's going on, and he knows everything that's going on with me. But I had to look and say, okay, where could I be of use? Can I be of use over here? Can I be of use in my family? Can I be of use in my job? And at that same time that some things were changing, I got to see the places I could be of use. We have two kids, Mackenzie and Anna. They're great. But, you know, we were going, okay, how much time are we really getting together as a family? You know, you read the family afterwards, you kind of find out about the two things is, you know, you either throw yourself into a job and money and fixing everything, or you throw yourself as far as you can into AA, and neither extreme works that well. And I had to kind of go, okay, where am I showing up as a dad? Where am I showing up as a husband? And I changed some of my meeting schedule. So out of this, those unfamiliar with the D.C. area, there's a huge number of suburbs all around, and I was driving around, you know, an hour out of my way to go to this one meeting because I had always gone to that one meeting, and that's where I go. You know, it's just where I go. Why would I change where I go? That's what my meeting is. And I took a chance. I was like, well, I'll go to this other meeting on Tuesday. Ran into some really good people. Solid, wonderful people in AA. They're, you know, me and three of these other guys are the ones that started the Saturday men's meeting together. You know, where can I be of use in other places? And so it all kind of solidified for me that I'm going to these different meetings, found this awesome big book study. We actually just read a chapter out of the book all the way through the stories, and then everybody gets a chance to share about it. And I had not read half the stories in the big book. You know, I stick to the 164. That's where the program is. But you start going through the stories, you're like, oh, crap, I relate to that. That's so good right there. And then this. And so I'm sitting in this big book study, and a guy comes in, a guy named Ed, and he, second go around in sobriety, you know, just says, yeah, it was getting a little hard. And, you know, my sister said, she's been sober a long time, said maybe I should go back to AA. And, you know, whenever I hear that, I'm like, okay, there's more to the story. Nobody ever got hard, and then maybe I'm going to show up back in AA. And so, you know, bits and pieces start to come out over time with Ed. But we just kind of talk at this big book study and, you know, okay, great, Ed, have a good night. And so a few weeks later, I'm at my neighbor's place. You know, we're having a backyard barbecue. Kids are all running around and everything like that. And I'm working the grill for my neighbor because he literally is a drunk. He's going through a terrible divorce right now because of his alcoholism. So he just doesn't want to bother. And so I look over across to the backyard, and Ed is over working on his yard in the backyard. I had no idea this guy lived backyards three doors down from me. and sees me not drinking, being a fellow in my community, and we talk for a while over the back fence, and I go back to what I'm doing. So fast forward a couple weeks, taking my kid to church, and, you know, she's being a jerk, and I'm trying not to be a jerk back to her, and I look a few rows behind me, and Ed's behind me, seeing me be a fellow in my community, seeing me be an active person practicing the principles of the 12 steps. So the next time I see Ed, you know, I need a sponsor, and I was wondering, and it wasn't anything he heard me say in a meeting. It wasn't anything that he saw me do in a meeting. He saw me in my community practicing the principles of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's kind of where it hit me, is that I've always been a big believer whenever I get in a 12-step meeting that this is way personal opinion on AA here real quick, okay? That there's just far too much discussion of, well, you know, I tried to sponsor somebody once, but it didn't work out. And these are the, and then sponsorship, 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 sponsorship. And there's, you know, two parts to the 12th step. We carry this message, but then we practice the principles in all our affairs. This, by far, will be the easiest hour of my day to practice the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I'm in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting surrounded by my fellows. The other 23 hours, they can get a little difficult. And so, you know, that really having a full and complete life in sobriety is one of those kind of big things. Also, excuse me, shortly after my anniversary this year, I was driving back to work one day, and I saw this car that was in front of me. It was driving kind of slowly, a little erratically, and I'm with a guy that I work with that happens to know I'm sober, and I, you know, kind of pull around the car that's driving slowly and erratically and say, somebody's day drinking or something like that. And we both have a kind of laugh, and I look in the rearview mirror, and the car slowly skids to a stop in the middle of a very busy road, kind of angled out into the right lane. And I look at my buddy, I'm like, Jeff, we got to stop and, you know, figure out what's going on here. And we stop, and somebody else had already stopped and was flagging traffic around it, and called a paramedic, and there was somebody just slumped over the wheel. Blonde guy slumped over the wheel. So, you know, we're flagging traffic around, and the, ambulance guy gets there and kind of rouses the guy behind the wheel. And this is the first time I actually see somebody's face. And he kind of pops up behind the windshield, and I'm like, Chris, crap, what the? And I, you know, walk over, and the ambulance guy is in the middle of kind of a very, you know, intense interrogation of Chris. Have you had anything to drink today? Have you had any drugs today? And Chris is sitting there going, no, no. And then Chris sees my face and goes, Paul. And the ambulance guy looks at me and goes, how do you know Chris? I said, well, we've met each other through a 12-step program. And the course of interrogation changes with Chris at this point. Chris, you're going to have to get out of the car. I put the car in park. I know you've had something today, Chris. When did you have it? And, you know, I kind of had to walk away going, I hope something good happens. You know, I shot Chris a text because I still had his number in my phone. And a couple weeks later, I got a text back that said, you know, it's got to be God's handiwork that I was there that day, and that, you know, he was back in rehab. And I noticed through, you know, some friends that he was doing okay for a few months. And then Chris died in early August. Just couldn't take it. And I'm at the memorial service for him, and I see a guy that I've known in sobriety for a very, very long time. But I would say we've probably said a total of about like 10 sentences to each other in the 20 years that we've known each other, but we've just always known each other in meetings. And he was trying to help out Chris with some other guys. And when Mike and I look at each other across the room, it was just this look that went, this probably isn't the last time we're going to see each other at one of these. And, you know, that is kind of a big deal in the last couple months. And so I want to give that present day, you know, that life will still go on in sobriety. And things will still change in sobriety. Though that sounds rather horrible and depressing, the men's meeting that I've got going on right now is going really well. I've got just an unbelievable life today compared to the way I was living before I got sober. So, okay. The youngest of five kids, grew up in Toledo, Ohio. We're going to go to that. This will all make sense in a minute. Youngest of five kids, grew up in Toledo, Ohio, and I wouldn't say I grew up in an alcoholic family. There's very little alcoholism in my family, but I think that alcoholism kind of runs a vein through just about any Irish Catholic family in one way or another. So I've got a sister who doesn't attend meetings, but ended up having to stop drinking a few years ago. I have an uncle that died with, probably 35 years sober or something like that. But of my immediate family, I am the only one who spends any time in these rooms. And so my parents had some knowledge of alcoholism, but, you know, it wasn't really something we talked about much. And so my freshman year of high school, my buddies and I get together one New Year's Eve and said, you know, we are going to set out to get drunk. There was no other plan. There was no other purpose. There was no, hey, let's have a beer. It was, we are going to set out to get drunk. And we did. And so it's a great night. Had a good time. My brother is the oldest of my family, three sisters, and then me. And so my sister's friends, seniors at the time, came back from their party. We had our own little party in the basement with the four of us and, you know, got to stay up that night, talk to pretty girls. Drinking was awesome. Awesome buzz. We kind of nearly got in trouble, but just missed it, you know, and then stayed up talking to my sister's friends. This is awesome. No repercussions whatsoever. And it wasn't off to the races after that. It was drink when I could after that. You know, third or fourth time, got drunk, severely blacked out, redesigned one of my friend's newly designed bathrooms by throwing up all over it. You know, later on, it's three or four years later, I was hanging out at her house. Her dad still stared at me and goes, do you know how long it took me to clean the wallpaper? Really, you can still see red stains. Go look at that wallpaper right now. Just had it done, and I ruined the thing. And, you know, later on, I get to college, and I had no supervision, but I had a lot of pride. So I kind of laid out a plan, and the plan worked like this. I am going to give you Sunday about noon through Thursday at about 5 o'clock. That will be your time. I will study. I will work my butt off. But from Thursday to five, till whenever I wake up or come to on Sunday, that is my time. And I will do whatever the heck I want during that time. And I did. So it went like that. And I made some simple rules for myself during that time that, you know, there was ways you could obviously tell if somebody was alcoholic. First one, you never drink alone. So always, you know, even if you're not drinking, you're in the room. I'm not drinking alone. Works out great. Other things that, you know, and, you know, you wake up so hungover, you can't make it somewhere. Can't make it to work. Can't make it to class. That's a sign of a problem. Okay, we're going to soldier straight through that. We will show up still drunk the next day. We'll show up so hungover that you shouldn't be standing up. We're going to show up so hungover that, you know, it took us 10 minutes to walk down a hallway kind of thing. It was because I was always going to make sure that nobody would be able to put it on me to say, let's talk about your drinking. the simplest and most basic rule that there was if I brush my teeth before I go to bed, everything is fine. No matter what. So I had this, I eventually kind of like built this body memory that, you know, there'd be some point where I'd be like, okay, let's start inching back toward, you know, my apartment at the time, because this is hitting the point where you're probably going to pass out and you don't want to be too far away. And plus, you brush your teeth, sleep in your own bed, everything's fine. That I'd kind of inch my party way back to my house, and I'd be at my regular party house where it was the same thing every weekend, to a T, same people, same music, same beer, same everything, same drama. You could, you know, plan on Trinda and Scott getting in a giant fight, and then you could plan on this, and you could plan it. And it was like clockwork every time. And so then sometime around 2 or 3 in the morning, I grab a last beer, stick another one in my pocket, kind of lean against a wall and go, I am probably going to pass out in about the next 10 to 15 minutes. See ya. Ghost the party. Go home. Try to have a last beer on my living room couch. Smoke a cigarette with my roommate. More than likely sit there and ash into the same can that I was drinking out of, because at that point, who cares? And brush my teeth. Pass out in bed. But I was in my own bed. I had brushed my teeth. Everything was fine. Nobody could put it on me because, hey, you know what? You passed out on somebody else's floor and got drawn on. I made it home. You didn't make it to class the next day? No, man. I made it. I could always point to that and say, see, I'm doing fine. No matter what, I'm doing fine. And it went on that way for a while. I was dating a girl at the time that I remember one morning we were talking, and I had woken her up from my bathroom floor. She was trying to hold time with me and couldn't. And so after I got her up from my bathroom floor, because she had passed out there, we were talking about, she's like, you know, some people are kind of like fun drunk. Like they, you know, they get a little giddy and it's kind of fun for them and that kind of thing. You're not like that. I was like, yeah, your point is. And we continue dating for a while, and then, you know, there's be these kind of just questions at times about, hey, how about we, you know, go rent a movie and stay in tonight? Why would we want to do that? There's beer and parties. Why would we want to stay in? And eventually along the way, we did break up in a terrible fireball, you know, four-lane crash of a terrible night of a breakup that, you know, fueled by alcoholism was what you would expect. And I was crushed, completely crushed. It seemed to come at me out of nowhere, even though I'm the one who broke up with her. Yeah, it's amazing how that happens. And so I go on for a few months deeper and deeper into alcoholism. You know, friends of mine are really starting to see I'm getting pretty out of control. And so one night, about 6 or 8 months after the breakup, I'm having a party at my place. It doesn't seem quite fun enough. I'm quite angry about a lot of things. I'd spent the last couple months vandalizing a construction site for no good reason on my way back to, you know, pass out at home. And a big tradition at the University of Dayton is dumpster fires for no good reason. And so I'm a angry, destructive person. And so I ended up getting caught this time. And so now you could hang something on me. And tried to kill myself that night. Tried to overdose on just regular painkillers, you know. Advil, took half a bottle. It doesn't seem like a big deal, but I know people who have actually died from that. And I have a niece that was dealing with depression earlier this year and literally put herself in a coma for about 2 days doing that. So I didn't think a big deal of it at the time until I found out people who actually killed themselves from it. I just know I woke up the next day and still had to face what was going on. So I got kicked out of school. I went with this great idea because I think that I can kind of maybe talk or charm my way out of a lot of things, that it wasn't that bad. My record wasn't that bad. There was, you know, no way that they could be able to get this on me. And I went into this kind of like student trial board with some faculty, staff members, and a few students, and tried to give this amazing appeal about what a stalwart member of the campus I was. Still, you know, carrying honors and involved in all these activities. Remember, Sunday noon to Thursday 5 were yours, so I looked like the model citizen during this time. And so, you know, I give all these great things that I've done, and then, you know, they give a chance for the prosecution, you know, the university to speak, and all they did was read my record. They went through every alcohol violation over the course of 2.5 years that I had had, every conduct violation over the course of 2.5 years that I had had, and then said, essentially, the recommended sentencing for this kind of vandalism is 8-year suspension from school, and then sat down. There wasn't, you know, a firework. There wasn't a, you know, trying to tear apart my argument in any way. They literally just read the record and the facts of who I was and what I had done and rested their case. I had nothing to say. I walked out of there going, okay, I'm just going to go tell everybody that needs to know that I'm not back next year because they don't have to, you know, wait a day to tell me I know what's going on here. And I launched into a amazing month and a half bender that, you know, sober during the day, but just absolutely crap-faced every night as much as I could. It helped that another buddy of mine that I had grown up with was getting kicked out of school at the same time, so he and I were sitting in the same spot. And then I had to attempt to go back to college because I was going to live with my parents, which as a deeply individualistic, responsible person was not where I wanted to be. And I did. I got back into a different college and had realized that I had spent so much time drinking and being a wonderful model student at this place that I literally tested back into classes that I had passed my freshman year of college because I did not remember much of anything from those. And didn't stop drinking, just changed the method. So after spending about 6 weeks drunk every night, I realized that that's not going to fly living at home, especially when people are keeping an eye on you for your drinking. And within a week or two, met a couple buddies that were like, stay on our couch. So used to be that I could pack a bunch more drinking into a week, but now I had to get it all into Friday and Saturday. And so I jammed as much drinking as I could into Fridays and Saturdays, and then tried to make the rest of the week look just fine. And it worked for a while. Got the chance to be back out on my own again. And within 2 weeks, I still to this day don't know if I was going home or going back to the other bar where my friends were. I just knew I was leaving my home bar. And, you know, being relatively close to Madison and UVA, that college towns clear out in the summer. And so I am living in Bowling Green, which is a college town, in the summer. And so, like, I even believe the police force drops in, like, half in the summer. So I had probably one of about 8 patrol cars in Bowling Green at that time directly behind me as I ran a stop sign, locked up the brakes, nearly T-boned somebody, and saw blue flashers go on right behind me. And I had no way to talk out of this one. You know, it's that feeling of absolute defeat when you know you're caught, when you know this is just not going to go well, and you don't have a way out, you're backed in the corner, and you've got to just finally kind of face the facts of who you are. So, get arrested for DUI that night. And I am now trying to figure out the best way out of this, because I have no way out of this, and I have to look over the record of my life at this point. And my life at this point is failed relationships, very, very few actual friendships that are based on anything other than just being in the same room with the person drinking at the time. The car that I had gotten the DUI in technically wasn't in my name, so I would need to call mom and dad to get it out of the impound lot the next day. And I had just gotten kicked out of school 3 months before. And if you grew up in my house, one of the big things that was never going to be okay was a DUI. I'm sure if I spent enough time talking with my parents about why, it probably goes back to the fact that one of my mom's brothers was hit by a drunk driver and, you know, survived, but had physical problems the rest of his life. And so that always just hung in her mind. And here I was, youngest son, ended up exactly where she didn't want me to be. And so figured out that I didn't own a firearm, so sucking on the end of the gun wasn't going to work. I didn't have any real good painkillers or sleeping pills, so taking a whole bunch of those wasn't going to work, and it was too darn far to walk to throw myself off an overpass. And, you know, I grew up in the flatland. There wasn't, you know, a decent mountain to jump off of or anything like that in the Great Lakes Midwest. And so I went through every household cleaner I could find in my house, and took a nice tumbler full of bleach, mixed in a little bit of Kool-Aid to make sure I could, you know, drink it and it would taste good going down. You got it. Come on. And so you got to have your chaser. You got to have your mixer. So Kool-Aid and bleach is not the best cocktail in the world, just so you know. Drank, you know, half of it down. And waited to die. And about 15 seconds later, I didn't die. But I was throwing up everything I had eaten for the last week. And, you know, just worse than I could ever feel. Tried to find a sharp knife, and that, you know, wasn't going to work either. And so flipped in the phone book, found a number for AA, and called Alcoholics Anonymous in Wood County. And it was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and somebody picked up the phone and said, you know, do you need help? And I am a prideful, unbelievably independent person who was bawling and crying on the phone and said, can you just tell me where a meeting is tomorrow? And they could hear me bawling and crying on the phone and said, well, where do you live? And I told them, like, okay, there's one a little bit down from me at this church. It's 7 o'clock on this night. Do you need someone to talk to you tonight? No. Slammed down the phone. Because like I said, independent and prideful, I'm not going to accept your help, even if you offer it to me at this time. And spent the next day trying to figure out what to do. And I had called the AA number. I knew where the meeting was. So you guys had to be expecting me. And I had to call my parents to get the car out of the impound lot and arrange that. So, you know, how do you couch the blow of, here's all the dumb crap that I've done, and I have confirmed every human living fear that you have about me, and being a parent right now, I understand the idea of having every human living fear that I've had confirmed, and then go, well, but I'm going to AA. And so that was my plan, is that I'm going to punch you in the face with all these problems, but then I'm going to try to hug you right away by saying I'm going to AA. And I went to this meeting, and I was a room a lot like this, actually. But it was just a sharing meeting, open discussion. And I rode up on my bike because I didn't have a car, and threw it down outside the meeting, grabbed a cigarette, and was smoking out there with this biker named Sam Smalley. And Sam, in my memory at that time, was about 6'6" and built like a Coke machine. I know Sam now. Sam is my size. Sam is built like me. At that time, Sam was 6'6" and built like a Coke machine. And so he's got, you know, his leathers on and scraggly beard and says, "What time is it?" Meeting started at 7. I said, "It's about 5 till 7. He said, "Okay, I got time to burn another." And I'm out there smoking a cigarette too, and I'm a smart aleck by nature. And so I said, "Yeah, it's a nasty habit." And he stared dead-eyed at me and said, "I've had worse." So I was unbelievably scared to walk into the room and go in. And, you know, I've been in enough board meetings or meetings for other organizations. You kind of tell the person at the center of the table is going to be the person who's in charge of the room. And Sam sits down at the center of the table. Great. The 6'6" mean biker who was just mean to me outside is now going to be in charge of this meeting. This is going to be wonderful. I have arrived at the worst place I possibly could in my life. And this guy is now going to be the one who is going to make it worse. And he noticed, it's a small town, that there was about 2 or 3 people like me in there that he had never seen in a meeting before, because Sam was a regular attender of meetings. So he knew his community, and he knew the people that he normally saw. And he also knew well enough that none of them was probably going to speak up and say that they were new. And so he said, "Hey, let's have a meeting on the first step." And I didn't notice, but he had, you know, a book next to him and a pen. And so he does this meeting on the first step. Sam knows his community and knows everything well enough that he kind of surveyed the room, noticed that all the people in the room looked, you know, that were new, 25 to 20 or something like that, and kind of purposely picked on some people either with extremely scary, bad, hard bottom stories, or that had just gotten sober at 25, had just gotten sober at, you know, 20. Sam had gotten sober when he was about 22. He had 15 years at the time. And went around the room. He didn't ask for hands. He basically designed that meeting for the 3 new people that were in the room, because he had the responsibility of being the chair that night. And after the meeting, he grabbed me and gave me the book that he was writing in. He had written out some things that I might want to look for in here. He had pointed out where the doctor's opinion was. He had pointed out the chapter, Family Afterward, only to say, "Look at this point right in the middle that we absolutely insist on enjoying life." I needed that at that time. I've run into a lot of new people along the way that might have needed a little ego and bravado broken down and might need to be shown themselves along the way. I probably have run into a lot more that need to be lifted up. The longer I've been sober, the more I realized that on that day, I absolutely needed to be lifted up. You know, you asked me at that time if I needed to be lifted up. I said, "No, I got fine. Everything's good. It's all good. Fine." But Sam knew I needed to be lifted up. And Sam pointed that out, that we absolutely insist on enjoying life. And Sam's somebody who definitely enjoys life. And him and his wife, Linda, during that summer when I was sober, were great friends of mine. Sam made sure I had people to go out with that night, to go to a diner. And I had ice cream at the diner. I'm a regular beer drinker, and cheap beer at that, in basements, in dirty houses. And you don't drink ice cream, you don't drink beer and eat ice cream together. They don't go together. I've said that several times. I've never run into somebody who went, "You know, really, I found that there's a great pairing with this kind of beer and ice cream." No, they don't go together. And I was sitting there eating ice cream going, "This is a pretty darn good ice cream. Like, I haven't thought about ice cream in a long time." And we played cards for a while, and, you know, the guy took my bike and threw it in the back of his truck, drove me home, made sure I got home pretty late, made sure I was pretty tired. I lived next door to a drive-through beer store at the time, and it was still open, but I didn't really notice it. I went home, sat in my dark apartment. I didn't have money, so I kept the lights off a lot, tried to keep the electric bills down because I'm stupid, had nothing to do. So I read the book. And like I said, found doctor's opinion there. Stuff made sense. And we got the car to the impound lot the next day, and I went out to dinner with my parents, but I needed to be home by 7 because Sam's guy, Mike, was going to pick me up at 7 for the 7:30 meeting. And then as I left the 7:30 meeting, I was told I needed to go home right away because Mike was going to pick me up at 6 in the morning because Sam was speaking at a pancake breakfast at 8 in the morning. And then I got told I was going to go to the 7 o'clock meeting that night. I didn't have other plans, so it wasn't like somebody was like really breaking up a giant social life for me. But I got shown where the meetings were in my first week. And I got rides to those meetings in my first week. And what I couldn't make on my bike, I could be able to have somebody pick me up because I didn't have a car. And it went on that way for quite a while. And, you know, eventually somebody said, hey, you got to get a sponsor. And because I was still scared of Sam, I was not going to ask Sam to sponsor me. And I went to the most gentle, loving person I could find in the Bowling Green AA community, a guy named John Schultz. And John had 20-something years and worked with lots of people. And it was another time where somebody with a lot of time that knew their community really well stepped up and did something I didn't expect. And John said, why don't you grab the pamphlet on sponsorship and let's sit down and talk about it. I said, great. Went, got the pamphlet, interrupted a noon meeting, walked in, got the pamphlet on sponsorship, and walked out of the noon meeting because I was told to get the pamphlet. And so then I had many people who were at that noon meeting going, are you okay? Are you okay? Are you okay at the meeting I was at that night? I'm like, I just needed to get the pamphlet. There's nothing wrong. I didn't even realize I was interrupting the meeting. Got it, read it, went and talked to John. And I said, well, I need a sponsor. And he said, you know, I'm working with actively about 6 or 7 guys right now. And I don't know if it's really going to work. Why don't you go talk to this guy, Doug? You know, Doug's probably going to be, you know, helpful for you. Now, what John was doing at the time is Doug had just over a year sober and a lot going on. John was getting Doug into service. And so Doug sponsored me for a solid year and a half, and then, or a little over a year, then I got a job and I moved to the D.C. area. And I didn't go to meetings for quite a while. You know, a few months, maybe 1 meeting, 2 meetings, 3 meetings. And I was going nuts. I was ready to drink again. I was hanging out with drinking people and drinking places. Without a program. I had a wonderful fellowship. I had meetings that I went to all the time in Bowling Green, but I didn't have a foundation in sobriety of the steps. I didn't have what was in here. And so I ran into another bunch of people at a meeting. I was working near the campus at George Mason University because I was running a telemarketing center there and I was recruiting students, and I saw there was an on-campus AA meeting. And I ended up running into a really enthusiastic bunch of people. And they, like Sam, scared the hell out of me. And they offered help, and I ran away. And I came back the next week, though, and they offered help again. And this time I stayed. And ended up, again, meeting one of the most unbelievably, naturally chilled-out human beings I've ever met in my life. And I am angry, loud, and intense by nature. And my sponsor, Josh, is not in any way. He's like conflict avoidance man, where I'm like, how can I make a conflict out of this to figure out what's going to happen? And I was sitting next to him in a meeting, and I was totally uncomfortable. And I just knew that he was nice to people. And I turned to my left and I asked him to sponsor me. And he did the same thing that happened to me after that first meeting. He made sure I had somewhere to be the next night and somewhere to be the night after that. And it's gone on that way since. That's what I try to do for the guys I sponsor today. So through that time in sobriety, there's been, you know, some ups and downs at different times. I've been in the career I've been in right now for about 15 years, about 14 years with the same company. And I am looked at as a leader in this place, and I'm looked at as somebody whose opinion can matter, and people actually rely on me for what I know and my expertise in certain areas. Like I said, I have two daughters who, you know, are just totally awesome. Those things have come through work in sobriety. About 3 years sober, I'm working in a sales job, and I do not care for our VP of marketing at the time. I believe that his work is completely worthless. And so one day my VP of sales is on vacation. My VP of marketing on an open sales floor asks me, why aren't you calling the leads I've gotten you guys in the program I have going on? And I decide at that moment, because I'm an idiot, to let him know in the most frank terms possible why I am not calling these leads. So I nearly start a fist fight on an open sales floor with someone who is just asking me a nice question. I am ushered from the room. Luckily, did not lose a job. Ushered from the room and told, Paul, why don't you go downstairs and have a cigarette? Okay. By the time I make it back up, my VP of sales, who is on vacation, is on the phone. I'm told, why don't you go in the office and talk to him? I am told, by no means am I to speak with the VP of marketing until my VP of sales gets back, and I am to act as if everything is okay. I knew at that moment there was only one thing that I could look forward to that night. It was having dinner with the guys before the Thursday night meeting. And I knew at that moment that once I sat down, I would have to look Pick in the eyes and say, oh, Mike, here's what I did today. And Mike would laugh at me and give me what I needed to know. And then Joe would come in and give me what I needed to know. Through sobriety, I'll wrap up here in a minute. Through sobriety also, I've come to know that the relationship with my sponsor is also very important. I got to have that person who knows me and knows what's going on with me. And I have to be able to be frank and honest and upfront with him, even when we disagree. And Josh and I have had some disagreements over time. And so shortly after, and it's not even shortly after, it's a few years after my second kid is born, I'm just struggling with being a parent. And Josh doesn't have any kids at this point. And he says, well, why don't you try to go talk to this guy? And I don't want to talk to that guy. He said, why not? I said, well, here's the things that I believe in. Here's what kind of he believes in. And I'm never going to see eye to eye with him on some stuff. He said, I'm never going to see eye to eye. And so finally, Josh is like, well, go find a book. You know, we were able to come to a solution. So I walk into Barnes & Noble, and anybody who's has kids or gone into a Barnes & Noble with kids, they've got like a whole kids reading section in the back. And luckily enough, they have all the parenting books right next to the reading section in the back. So, mind you, prideful, independent, and I care what you think about me. So I happened to walk in on the Sunday where all the happiest families with all the nicest kids who had everything going on perfectly were in the reading section. I literally just kind of walked over, sent my kids into the reading section, and then didn't even, like, just went, just grabbed something without even looking. Flipped real quick and went, that sounds like my inventory. Okay, kids, let's get out of here. Called my sponsor about it. He's like, well, what do you think's going to happen? I'm like, I don't know. But I know I took an action. And I know that an action is the first step to doing something. And there's actually a lot of good things in that book that, you know, still kind of work through life today. But I have to be honest with somebody in a meeting with AA, or maybe even out of a meeting in AA, be honest with my spouse, be honest with my coworkers, be honest with my boss, to be able to have a place to start. And a big thing that's in my mind lately is just my words matching my actions. Congruency is a term that I've heard lately, that, you know, who you are matches up to what you do. And I've seen through sobriety, there's been times I have that and the times that I don't. And the times I have it, I'm able to kind of radiate a message. I'm able to have that, you know, it's in the 12th step, but the manner in which he carries himself lets the newcomer know he's a person with a real solution. When I'm being congruent, I have that. When I'm not in touch with a sponsor, when I'm not living this program out there in the other 23 hours in the day, I don't have that. And newcomers can smell BS. They're looking for ways that they can go, see, he's full of crap, I don't have to do this. And so the more I can live congruently, the more I can put the pieces together and truly live honestly who I am, the more I can carry this message and practice these principles in all my affairs. So thanks for letting me share.